This is Peter Elting, November 9th, 2001. Psyche and the Internet.
Really light and airy, but I always feel in anything that I do that to do with passion and a little humor makes it so much easier to understand, even if it's tragedy and a grave thing. I'm indeed a Jungian analyst, so I'm glad I could show up since I heard you had a little problem getting people to Seattle. I always enjoy coming here because Seattle was my first welcoming community as I was freshly graduated. I got sort of my christening under the fire in Seattle when I arrived full of ideals from Zurich. The ideals I still have, but I'm not in Seattle anymore. Now I'm in San Francisco. Psyche and the Internet, you read the description, and we will more or less follow and hit on all this format. It has always intrigued me because as an extroverted Jungian analyst, my technical know-how is 0 minus 5, and I so often sat in this front of this wonderful Macintosh computer that I bought in 85 or sometime, and while it was working just fine, and suddenly I had a blank screen, and I screamed. Had this sinking feeling that I was up against a superior power. So that's been sort of the thought of, well, I really want to talk about what this psyche and internet is and what it does to our psyche and look at it from a number of angles. I've chosen just arbitrarily, there are many ways to look at it, that I wanted to look at it today from the standpoint of relationship. Meaning, what relationship do we form to what we do on the web? How do we relate to the parts of ourselves that we project into the web? May those be parts of ourselves or our soul, whatever we want to call it, in its mystical way or less mystical way. And in it then, you know, we need to say what relates, you know, relation really is nothing but narrating a story. So there is a story behind it that we create on one hand, and then we draw it out again and listen to it. And we're in awe. Our relationship, however, is changed somewhat because suddenly our relationship is only through digital images, bytes, and words. So everything has been reduced to a different or to one medium only. Now, before I continue, the happenings on September 11 didn't go totally by me either, because I was in the middle of writing this lecture and I had trouble, as so many of us, with great periods of being unfocused and full of anxiety. And I thought, on earth can I concentrate on writing on psyche and the internet when this is happening? And I guess I had the personal part in it that I'm willing to share, that it hit me even stronger because as a young boy, I was born in Germany. I sat in a German town and had to run to the air raid shelter for 2 years in a row. And so suddenly I was thrown back in there thanks to Osama bin Laden. This lecture isn't about that, and I'm purposefully not focusing on it, although with some try I could have found many internet openings into this happening too, because fanatism and culture and religion do get spread through the internet and various other media just as well. But on purpose, I'm staying away from it, but I also felt I wanted to mention and share that it is not unnoticed. It was especially not unnoticed when I was at a meeting in Montreal 2 weeks ago, and at the international newsstand at the airport, I saw a copy of the German Time magazine, and it had this picture, which is a very powerful picture. The titular says, New York, the Wounded City. And, you know, it's powerful in the sense where when you look through the international press and the German and Swiss presses that I follow, is that it really was a wounding of the Western civilization and the Western world. So just in memory of all of that, I wanted to put this picture up briefly to say, well, there it is, and that's what happened. I'll leave it up for a moment. So clearly, you know, this whole thing is also the perpetrator in this whole thing. We all know this name, Bin Laden, by now, is seen in almost every picture that he has in front of either a video camera, a TV camera, or he has a laptop computer with him. So it's clear that the internet in its global connectiveness is well in it. Let me leave this, though, now and move you back to the image of relationship. And all through, I want you to see in your own mind, get an image of what your relationship to the web is, in whatever nature, how you use it, are you in some kind of a relationship to it? And when we look at relationship, we have to say, well, there is of relationship, there is a cognitive part and an affective part. Now, the cognitive part is easily consumed in the internet. The affective part, the embodiment, is not. So we're already looking at a difficulty in consummating a total relationship. So there's, let's say, four types of relationship. A relationship to self. How do we relate to it? What does that do to us? There's a relationship to the outer, to the thou, to the divine. There are relationships to intimate friends or acquaintances. And there's a relationship to time and space. And when you look at it from a time and space standpoint, you could say, I don't know whether you have ever seen this, what some people call the cross of reality, which is space here, time here. And really in time, what constitutes where we are here now is exactly in this ideal point, right in the middle. So, and that's the point where the internet operates from very often, because that's all you get. You get a hit and a bite at that moment. We often form relationships on the net and we end them on the net. It's a very problematic happening, and I will get back to that in greater detail. I have some case examples from friends that are quite heart-wrenching when suddenly relationships or even acquaintances end in this disembodied way. Interestingly enough, I'm thankful to Russ Lockhart in one of his earlier articles. He talked about relationship, and he found out, good researcher that he is, that the word relationship was introduced in the English language only in 1744, and it was seemingly introduced by the famous 18th century poet Alexander Pope. So it is quite astounding, I think, when we think that Shakespeare wrote all his stuff on relationship without ever using the word. Not a single time. That's just as a little side and to prime the pump a little bit. The Oxford Dictionary puts it more succinctly. It says, a relationship is a connection or an emotional bond between two people. Now you know exactly what it all is, and you don't have to go see any counselors anymore. So a lot of it, I think, continue to be in awe, as 75% of us use email and various other things, about this rapid connectivity that we suddenly can, you know, sometimes it's overwhelming. Sometimes when I open my email and I have 10 emails and I'm saying, wow, what am I going to do with all of that? How do I relate to the individual ones? Computers still are, you know, being treated by some people in a rather funny way. I found this rendition of a little German cartoon, which they called problem analysis. Now, I often think about the computer and the internet exactly in those terms at times. That same little magazine has a lot of funnies in it, but I know we can't just, you know. I'm not the editor of the New Yorker to run this lecture only by funnies, but I was tempted to. It probably looks just as well this way. This says, He can't speak yet, but he already knows how to work on three programs. So, that only by way of showing that, you know, we're still kind of struggling in relating to this whole phenomenon. And as we know in culture, what we do then often, we poke fun at it for a while until we get really the feeling, how serious is it? Is it really serious? Einspeichern. Einspeichern. Einspeichern means to, what do you call it when you put a new program on a computer? What do you call it? Install. He already knows how to install three programs. So, English language, very difficult. And then there's Time Magazine sent me as a freebie their online new magazine in town and it into my house, and it has, look how lovely this looks. Why do I always do this? And it has, this is, oh, okay. Now here you have these wonderful headlines, you know, here is how real people are using the net to follow their dreams. The web changed our lives. I mean, this sells copy. This is a wonderful idea. But it is like selling computer programs because they don't tell you how difficult it is to to design a website and do this and that. When you have... Now, who has a computer in this room? You have a computer. Oh, who doesn't? Okay. How many of you already had a crash of this computer or some program? Oh, I see some cynical smiles as they're raising their hand. Yeah. How many of you use email? How many of you feel the web has changed your life? Ah, you see, so they're not so far off. They're doing something. So I hesitantly bought my computer in 85. It was an Apple, and, you know, it's true. It helped me because suddenly I got an urgent email in from John Krauser or Lucretia while I was sitting in Tuscany tasting olive oil, saying, we don't have the description of your lecture for our... So without the computer, it would have never made it into the publication, you know, so there it is. So before I go too far... I go too far apart in my ramblings, which I could easily do. This is just my guideline here. You know, I need to look at it occasionally so that you get at least some resemblance of a package that you may understand. But I already warn you, since the internet, in my opinion, is a dilemma of good and bad, I will leave you in that dilemma. I will not solve it for you because it's boring to just go for the anthropocentric approach and saying what's good, what's bad, so all good. Now we decide it's all good. No, it isn't. It's bad and good. So we need to stay in that dilemma. But I will define a little bit psyche, computer, the web, and the internet. And I will then also look at this question of, we look at it, you know, what is potentially good or bad in it. So I will go the anthropocentric, I like this word, I can't pronounce it, that's my only problem. Our subjective valuation of it is what it means. But, you know, it is like everything, it bores me really to just look at what's good and bad. It's the same if I would give a lecture on, is this an inner value or an outer value? I don't think life is that oppositional. The second one, the second hypothesis that I'm going to tease you is... Does the information age potentially force a new direction? Does it reverse our journey from inner to outer? What happens when we connect to this global web that is behind the screen that we have created, that we live in it? It wouldn't exist without us. All that's in it is us. So are we moving more towards an outer way? It has really nothing to do with extroversion, introversion, because both extroverts and introverts use it, they just use it in a different way. I'm actually indebted to this by my German friend, Wolfgang Gigerisch from München, who wrote a wonderful article on the WW and the logical life of the soul. Actually, he wrote it in German, and it's impossible to understand in German. He's a philosopher, and he Hegels and Nietzsches you all through 20 pages to death, and by the time you get through, you never want to read Nietzsche again. But he has some good thoughts. So that I have from him, really, the idea, but I had the idea also before, but I've drawn upon it. But I'll read you just, I ask a couple of colleagues. Some of you know John Beebe. So I asked John, well, what do you think about psyche and the internet? He said, here's what he said. I wrote it down. Actually, I asked him to send me an email, and he did. He said, my sense of the internet, particularly through the white magic of email, is that keeps me continuously aware of my participation in the web of relations. Now, as if he knew what I needed for my lecture, to hear that word relations in there, because exactly my feeling. Well, then I asked Beverly Sabritsky. Some of them you know Beverly Sabritsky, well-known New York analyst, married to Phil Sabritsky, who is also an analyst. Beverly said, it presumes closeness, allowing intimacy, making comfortable with distance. All very good attributes of the internet. Well described, very succinct. It is any externalization of the unus mundus. You just trust me that it is. I won't explain it. Which is the world at large. It's like the concept of the world soul. My colleague Pat Warming is here, and I know she knows more about this. So she could explain it if you're interested in it later. It allows the privacy of the individual in relation to the many. It allows the privacy of the individual in relation to the many. I think it's very well put. So I'm sharing it just that way with you. Now here's a rogue artist in the Jungian world, Jim Hillman. Now he wrote 7 years ago a book that is 100 years of psychotherapy and the world's getting worse. And I'm indebted to this quotation to my friend Jan-Peter Hallmark, who in May did a lecture at the Jung Institute in Zurich as I was passing through to Tuscany that he conveniently entitled Jungians and the New Information Technology Society. Will Jungian therapy survive in a world of standardization, rationalization, and globalization? He had a lot of fun with it, but amongst others, he quoted Hillman, and I'm quoting Hillman and him. And I'm quoting Hillman just the way he wrote it because I didn't dare change anything. Therapy, analysis, in its crazy way, by emphasizing the inner souls and ignoring the outer souls, that's why it is apropos to my hypothesis. What are we doing? There's an inner soul, an outer soul. Part of our soul has become an outer soul in as much as it is behind the screen. It's hiding in the web that we wove. Supports the decline and devaluation of the actual world. Yet therapy goes on blindly believing that it is curing the outer world by making better people. We have heard that for years and years and years. It is high time that we stop putting ourselves in the center of our attention and instead open our eyes to see what happens out there and what we may do to improve the world by finding new solutions. He continues to malign the backward journey as part of the inner child archetype. Now, that's when it gets a little sensitive. You know, as a Jungian, we don't do that. But he has a point there. He says, we are, and that is also my point, we are changing our focus into an outer direction, and I will say more to that. And, you know, I saw this ad here somewhere that, you know, put the seriousness of the internet into perspective by running, I'm going to get this right. Nope. By putting the seriousness of the internet, it's a full ad that said, if the internet is changing the world, shouldn't the grown-ups be in charge? It's a course offering for senior surfers. Since I'm turning 65 next year, I thought, well, I have to pay attention to this kind of stuff. I'm going to attempt to quickly define psyche for you for the sake of this evening at least. We all know it has these wonderful Greek translations of butterfly, soul, spirit, and breath. As well as it is really, for the sake of this lecture, I would like to call it the total of all our psycho-logical functioning. That's the psyche. It contains all of it. I mean, at the root, we know, is the Apulean myth of Psyche and Eros from 220 BC. The interesting part in that is, as I draw the parallel to the internet in that, is that it's a human falling in love with the god Eros. And the minute the god shows himself, it goes kaput. So is there something hidden in the web that is too divine for us to see? And when we really see it, we're done with. Then we will be caught in the web just the same. Food for thought. Now, psychology could study whether these new forms of communication are liberal or soulful, or they're inauthentic, abstract, and a poor substitute for the real relationship. But in this way, I would feel I would waste your time and my time in the sense, because then we would again just discuss the old question, is it inner or is it outer? Is it subject or is it object? Is it human person versus factual information? So we would get stuck in this choice between this or that. Is this better or this better? I much more like to look at it in a more fundamental shift, that there is some deeper understanding of the outer soul, of the world soul that is created by this web that we are weaving, and we're weaving it for a reason. We think it's all in our service, but we all know the technology isn't necessarily all in our service. It's also the other way around. Oh, here's the senior surfer. So what is a computer? I struggled hard with this because I know you were all waiting for a Jungian analyst to fly up to Seattle, the city of technology, for me to define what a computer is. I'll give you, now I highlighted it so hard it's difficult to read. A brief dictionary description that spoke to me is simply it's an electronic device for storing and processing data according to instructions given to it in a variable program. It's no more, no less. It's a box. Clearly we all use it, and I use it for email and addresses and this and that, and it's of great help. And I tell you, there is a new complex in our society, which is my computer is down or my email is down. It rates higher than other emotional stress. Clearly, people come into my consulting room and I have a visceral feeling of a depression going. I say, what's going on? My God, who died? What's going on? My email is down. It's a tremendous. If you haven't spent $9 and picked up David Sedaris' latest book, Me Talk Pretty, one day, you ought to do it quickly because it's an uplifting book and he's a great humorist. David Sedaris, S-E-D-A-R-R-I-S. And I'm going to read to you what he said about the computer. He said, it was my father's dream that one day the people of the world would be connected to another through network of computers. He continued, call me naive, but I seem to have underestimated the universal desire to sit in a plastic chair and stare at a screen until your eyes cross. Due to my general aversion to machines, still Sedaris talking, and a few pronounced episodes of screaming, I was labeled a technophobe, a term that ranks fairly lowly on my scale of fighting words. The word phobic has its place when properly used, but lately it's been declawed by the pompous insistence that most animosity is based upon fear rather than loathing. I fear snakes. I hate computers. My hatred is entrenched and I nourish it daily. I'm comfortable with it and no community outreach program will change my mind. So much for Sedaris. But I think, you know, some of what he talks about, the doubt and insecurity we have around these powerful machines, we harbor that in us ourselves. A humorist reflects the collective zeitgeist, and I think he does it quite well. Now, the new technology also drives me and everybody else crazy, because suddenly people expect, A, that I can be reached every time, and B, when I talk to somebody, I can already feel the energy go away because I think they're email ready, answering the phone, watching TV, and waiting for a fax. So I always say now, let me hang up and call you again. Or I get phone calls, as you have on the answer machine, when I answer the phone, people saying, well, sorry, I just wanted to leave a message. I said, well, let's talk about it. Well, I don't have time. Thank you. It happens. So time and space, speed has suddenly taken on a value that it totally does not deserve. Speed has suddenly become the valuable element in our society. It isn't the contents we fill it with. Nobody gives a damn. It's just how many things can we do at the same time. And some people are going the other way now. They're disconnecting. I'm one of them. I called AT&T the other day and I said, I'm tired of this stupid little voicemail I have on this cell phone that I carry for emergencies, just in case somebody needs to talk to me right now. Nobody has the number, so it won't happen. Because I use it only for my own pleasure. But here, occasionally I give out the number when I travel, and then I had a voicemail on there. And I have to call some silly number far away and listen to people dropping things on it. So I called AT&T and said, disconnect. I said, disconnected, sir, it's part of your benefit package. We're talking like health insurance administrators. I said, well, I want to disconnect it. And I said, well, she said, the operator, who I haven't met personally, she said, you're a strange one. I think, thank you. I said, do you give analysis or is this... Well, I asked her where she was situated. She was in San Antonio. I said, well, that figures. Now let's move. Those were just little playground bases for where I want to lead you. Now we're going to jump right into the web or the internet. Now, I was informed by some webby technical people that the web and the internet are really not the same. There is a finite difference. One is this and that. For me, for tonight, can we indulge in just saying it's the same? You know? It's the same. For the sensate of you, and I know you want to do that, how long do I have here in the pit? Till 9? No? Till 9:15? Good. Good. Please, on your own time. So let's just assume it's the web and the internet are interchangeable. So for the sensate mind, I mean, all of you know it much better than I do. I read up on it, though, so I want you to do. I've done my preparation for this lecture carefully. It was some military silly thing in 73 called whatever, NJSF, NET, DARPA, and all whatever. In 91, some figures are interesting. In 91, 4 million people used it. And today, the estimate is at least 210 million people are on the email every day. I mean, staggering. A staggering growth. Trillions of data moving around on a global basis, and it's maddening. A couple of things. What does it do? It stores data. Businesses are operated out of it. You know, many times I must admit the web has gotten me off the hook because I found something would have probably taken me a couple of days if I had driven around from brick-and-mortar store to brick-and-mortar store trying to find it. It reduces the cost of doing business, facilitates business interaction, saves time, brings people together. There is a dearth of e-therapy and e-everything. There isn't anything e that isn't out there. And I will show you some examples that will stagger you. But the most interesting part of the whole internet or web to me is we named it that. We named it the internet. And we named it the web, being fully aware that spiders weave webs to catch things, to kill them and eat them. And they are the weavers, and they use it for that. Now, if we stay with that metaphoric parallel and apply it to the web, it also rings true to me, because the web would not exist if we wouldn't create it. So if we wouldn't project part of the soul, our subjective soul, into it, whatever form that takes, it wouldn't exist and be part of the world soul. So it is coming together, as I think part of us is using this outer global platform to bring, to move out of the inner direction. And I will go into a bit of history around that. So we will have to hold the tension of the web image, that it is nourishing and devouring at the same time, and we can't get away from that. So it becomes now, it is still very new with us, but it becomes our task to look at what it does for us specifically, always realizing the web has no morals. The web will be there. The web doesn't have a moral judgment. You can find anything on the web. Lo and behold, 40% of the web is filled with pornography. 40%. I was staggered when I read that percentage. So what does that say about today's society? It's closely followed. The next 36% of all web content is connected to the helping profession and spirituality and personal growth. That doesn't leave much for all these important data that people tell me, scientists, it leaves a bare 25% of all this other stuff that is so valuable to all of us. So you can imagine how little you and I occasionally access in the web. I mean, I don't know about you, but I never do these other things. I don't know where they get these percentages from. So the biggest aspect of the internet for me is, and I call it that, and I don't know whether I read it somewhere or whether I found this termination, this term myself, is I call the internet an identity laboratory. And you can keep that in mind, because that's an important point. What do I mean by that? You know, email essentially is a cold communication as such, because it doesn't really hold emotion. You can put attempts of emotion in it, but it still maintains it is a written word, byte, digital, cold communication. As much as people use it in a disinhibiting way and put emotional words in it, but it still doesn't hold the emotion. So the next thing is, why are we so addicted to the internet? Why so many people? Why do clients tell me that they just had a late night and played at some 2 o'clock at some game where somebody killed somebody and they won? 4 hours in front of this tube. Addicted. Well, because the internet is very smart. Really, at the basis of all the stuff on the web, nothing has changed. They're presenting it the same way all these things that addict us have always been presented. When you look at it, the basis of it is variable reinforcement. Behavior therapy, behavioral science 101. Variable reinforcement. They give you a bit of that, and then they lead you to a bit of that, and then you get nosy and you want to hear a bit of that. And there's a link to that. And next thing, they got you, because what has happened? A web has been woven, and they got you. We're not any different. You think Skinner's rats were stupid little rats. We're the same. We have a mouse. We even call it a mouse, not a rat. We could call it a rat. We're surfing with our rat in our hand. No, we have a mouse. So we have progressed a big way from Skinner. We don't use rats anymore. Now we have mouse. So we're not pressing the bar, but we are pressing our little mouse all the time. Click, click, click. And the more things change, the more we stay at the same. You know, the internal locus of control is more, you know, we get into it because when they got us, the time sink effect, another behavioral term, takes place. Suddenly, you lose time. You don't even know how long you're on it. And we all have seen it happen to us. Suddenly I say, wow, I've been on this for half an hour? Well, I only wanted to check this thing, not knowing that unconsciously, through variable reinforcements, they have led me on a whole journey. Well, when we look at now online, pornography covers 40%. Well, it isn't all that surprising, really, because if it's an identity laboratory, what better way to play out various identities than on the web? Because anonymity and identity can be created without punishment. You stay in your anonymity so you can create any identity you want, part true, totally false. Nobody can check it, and it's just running amok. And there's really difficult to restrict it. How can you restrict it? You really can't do it. No, I mean, it's a question whether, you know, how many people are really interested. Somebody, has a webcam in his room and a couple says, we're going to show the world how we're going to lose our virginity. It's probably happened as we speak. You know, everything is on there. The overuse and the helping sides mushroom. I mean, second to porn, you know, it's all connected to helping and spirituality. The strange phenomenon to me is, as I checked out a few, and I will share a couple of those sites with you later because they're quite interesting. Some of them even claim to be run by Jungian analysts, and unfortunately they are. And is the fact that it seems very clearly we are much more apt to give advice on the internet freely, free of charge, than helping a homeless on the asphalt. Where are all those asphalt helpers when we need them to run a homeless shelter? Nobody has time. But on the internet, they have a website free of charge. Very few of them charge. You can get therapy, dream interpretation, behavioral therapy, addiction counseling, you name it, it's out there, big time. So, Peter Wallace, in a little treatise he wrote on psychology of the internet, he said, cyberspace is not just for geeks and day traders. Psychos go there too, so join the stew. Thanks. So where was I? So let me lead you back that the World Wide Web could essentially be an essential new orientation in the world from inner to outer. Now, I'm going to lead you a little back into just a tiny bit of history so I put some roots as to that loose statement that some of you are wrinkling their head and I say, wait a minute, my whole life is inside me. What are you talking about? So is mine. Girish said, and I agree with him, that when we look at the 18th century, men's orientation was really towards the outside. It was nature where it all happened. The soul traveled outside. You remember these many, especially shamans, always left their body. So they were moving out in their spirituality. You remember dream stories of the Australian Aborigines, who basically at night when they fall asleep, their perception of the world is they become an eagle and they circle the world. They become the world soul. And in the morning as they wake up, they slip back in the body and live as that real body for another day until at night they take off again. So that's one concept. So during this time of myth and spirit, we looked into nature and up to the gods as man understood himself as a child of nature. Now, consequently, in the 19th century, we became disenchanted with nature, and there were people like Nietzsche and others who really didn't want to have anything to do with nature. He said, man needs to look for the divine outside. Then we, well, I'm included, I guess, but my forefathers, or my not role models, I hate that word. Anyhow, Freud and Jung came along. Freud came along around the turn of the century, and he said, this business going to the outside for your happiness and your soulful life is no good. You've got to go the other way around. God is inside. You've got to go inside. So the basis for depth psychology was founded on the principle, essentially, as you well know, being somewhat Jungian-oriented, and as I am, and I'm also a believer of it, that the inner journey begins... Jung called it the journey of individuation, by looking towards the inside, looking towards your dreams, and that what the unconscious brings us to help live us, make us live a more integrated and full life. So we turned inside to the unconscious and to dreams and to hidden personal memories. And Jung really convinced us that... It was introspection that was needed for us to find meaning in life. I mean, I have a personal beef with him because I'm an extrovert and he never wanted to have anything to do with us, but he coined the phrase. So this excursion into history, I just wanted to give you a little bit of the backdrop for my hypothesis, where I say, and now what I see is a strong tendency that this essential orientation that we have had, that Jung and Freud started in the depth psychology field, is changing as we are looking, whether we are introverted or extroverted, as we are looking to behind the screen that we created this web on a global basis in this connectivity, where split parts of our soul live behind the screen to bring our subjective soul also out there and incorporate it. Otherwise, I would find little reason why the web is so powerfully created by us, because it only lives because we make it live. We used to be the vessel of the unconscious energy or the libido, but the internet and web, in the internet and web, we are somewhat reduced to being just a human interface. The place of life, the place of soul, is out there, but it's also behind the screen. So if we find our subjective soul and the world soul that we need to connect to I'm reading a little bit off that because it's fresh out of my mind, and so I have to keep reading it to make sure I believe it also. But it is my thought. The web is not only all around us, we also constantly cocoon ourselves into its information and images when we log on to the web, and only by doing so, by logging in and unwrapping ourselves in it, the web is confirmed and maintained. It is truly the web in the first place. We constantly feed it and we weave it. So we're back to the dilemma. To hold the balance, is it good or bad? Maybe the future will teach us. We don't know. Both symbolically and literally, the world is more out there as we stare many hours on that screen. The place of soul could be behind the screen. It is a scary thought in its category finality, I think, but I think we ought to be open enough to entertain that thought, because the web and the internet can only exist because of our projections into it and what we create into it. So in the end, of course, I'm teasing you with this hypothesis, nothing is so black and white. But we know from history and of religion that, and history of religion and philosophy, that the locus of being always changes. It has been part of our history. When you read the history of religion and philosophy,
There have been always periods where the locus of our meaning and our soul is out, and then it's in, and then it's out, and then it's in. So it isn't firmly implanted. In the internet, clearly, we don't see any facial expressions. We can't hear a voice yet, although that's coming, and I'm sure facial expressions are coming. Next thing, we have a little camera peeking at us, and we can't even fool anybody this way anymore. Terrible thought. We construct images with a forward direction. And really, already, these images, by and large, lack a certain mythical or metaphysical backing. They are really, in itself, deplete of meaning. We have to put the meaning into them. Now think about that. It's true, though. They are to be filled with meaning by us and nobody else. The internet is a hybrid to both extrovert and introvert, so that's not a road I'm going to take, because it is just a different way of what we do with the web and the internet as an introvert or an extrovert. I sometimes go crazy in my extrovert contact. It is just simply easier for them. They can open up much better through the written word on the internet than before. And I've known many introverted friends who will readily admit that. And there's no shame in that whatsoever. The trouble, though, becomes, and I will make a big point of that in any moment now as we move into email, is we're creating what in therapy we call a dual relationship, whether we like it or not. One online, one offline. We're creating two lives. And then it gets a little tricky. There are books out already on Nancy McWilliams wrote a book, Psychoanalytic Diagnosis of Internet. It gets quite hilarious with the stuff she comes up with. Anybody of you looked at that? I'll give you a couple of examples just to tweak your curiosity. She asks questions like, do schizoids tend to be lurkers? Do manics impulsively launch off email without proofreading and later regret it? I have a couple of those friends. They send all, or whatever is in there, whatever address book or so, anything that moves on their computer, in or out, indiscriminately, so that I've basically taken them off my list and ditched them, and I say, I don't want to see you, talk to you, just call me on the phone, don't leave a message if you have something to say. Are hackers antisocial? Are compulsives drawn to the computer because they can control the relationship? Ooh. Ooh. We could spend a whole lecture on that piece. So we're in a constant dance of exception and rejection of the web. Clearly, we're looking at that. But the main thing is that these are machines and it's a web we have created. We are different. We are different from machines, aren't we? I mean, don't you think you're different from a machine? I think I'm different from a machine. Because I have emotions and I have a body. So the ultimate relationship can be completed only when, in an embodied way, I can bring emotion and feeling into it. And I've tried it on email and it has always backfired. Because it was either too much or too little. So email corresponds is kind of a beauty and a beast, you know. It helps and it hinders. So there we are again, the dilemma. And I'm sorry, I have to leave you in it. I won't take you out of it. Well, then there's, of course, this whole category, and I'm going to leave this out too because it's too touchy and I don't want to hurt anybody's feeling, are these chat rooms. Wonderful chat rooms. People meet there for relationship. Crazy people walk in there with partial identities and saying, you know, I'm the 15-year-old son and he's a 65-year-old geezer sitting around. we're back to what I said earlier. It's an identity laboratory. In the wonderful anonymity, you can do anything you want. Now, one time when I was very cerebral, I sort of was touched by this thing about relationship. I think I got it. Now, here's what I came up with as a relationship pattern. Now, look at this for a second. It's not perfect. It's just a thought. It's, I'm not going to write a book on it. But what seemed to me is, you know, a lot of relationship gets enhanced and destroyed through and with email because it gets stuck in this dual relationship. There is this relationship online, and then it gets embodied offline, and it goes, kafoom, what happened? You know, you're not even close to what I projected into you in this ideal projective field. So suddenly what comes into the embodied relationship is a lot of that old trauma, this frozen experience that hasn't shown. Or it gets too hot. It's nothing but projection. You're deeply in love, and bingo. And I have some examples here. But let me look at dual relationship first. What do I mean by that? By that I mean it's simply that if I have a relationship through the web, through email, a relationship of any kind. But let's presume it's a love relationship because there is this emotion or a good friendship. Well, it lives on the net and through email, but when all said and done, you have lived a projected life through email. Now you meet this person again, and it may be like a long-distance relationship. You meet him or her only ever so often. Now you can have it overlap and that's what I said in email. Now, but that's not what I'm going to say in person. Now, in person, I'm going to tell you this. Doesn't work. It has to come together. So what do? We don't write intimate emails? Awfully tempting sometimes, isn't it? So easy, it seems. A very good friend of mine, she's a very fine Jungian analyst, a woman I know. She had fallen in love with somebody and then the relationship suddenly fell apart after a few meetings and was begun and ended very hot in this hot projective field on email. What can I say? She's a wonderful woman. She's a smart woman. She's an excellent Jungian analyst. She's no better, shouldn't he? It doesn't work that way. You don't. You get caught. She wrote, though, and she gave me full permission to tell you that, in a perceived letter that she didn't send, at the ending of it, she explained it this way. And I think it's apropos to the danger of this dual relating that is not integrated. And I will say a word on integration just in a moment, too. Oh, my God. I started to understand her letter. I started to understand what happened. I believe that your relationship to me brought out unlived, repressed parts of you that either you had forgotten, never shared, or even didn't suspect existed into you. These parts were incompatible with the images you had of yourself, all these persona you had built. These shadowy, split off bits. I mean, it's a bit of a psychological interpretation, but it gives us a bit of, we are psychologically oriented, aren't we? You want to hear the rest of it?
Yeah.
Split off bits could not be repressed or denied as long as you were in contact with me, because in your mind, through projections, I was bringing the best and the worst in you. They scared you. You were losing control, and you could not reconcile the image of yourself with what you were living emotionally and sexually. Instead of working it through in yourself, you sacrificed me in order to regain total control of yourself. This is an unfortunately very common failure of resolving a crisis. Jungians call it the regressive restoration of the persona.
Well,
now you know what happens when these relationships, and I'm not making light of this because my very first exposure to the power of it was actually when a young man walked into my consulting room. And all of you who are in therapy and see people, a person walks in and you can feel the bodily depression. It's an endogenous depression that's deep. It shows in the body. For me, I always say, it almost smells. It's so strong. We talk, I said, you know, good analyst, you know, ask open questions and all this, and we talk for half an hour longer, 45 minutes. And I claim to be a relatively inquisitive interviewer. I couldn't make heads or tails of it. Finally, after about 45 minutes, he said, and then, you know, he said, when I logged on again, I said, oops, I just heard something. I said, you logged on again? Yeah, as he said, I met her in a chat room, never seen her, had this most intimate, he brought me examples, most intimate, disinhibiting, loving, disclosing relationship in this chat room. He was all ready to meet her, and she said, no way, Jose. I'm out of here. Goodbye. Don't call again. And left the chat room. And he entered analysis. Very sad to see, but it proves the point of relationship gone afoul when we project something in the web and the internet that the web and the internet is not able, it may be willing, but it isn't able to give, which is an embodied relationship. It isn't able to. It stays virtual. So what has to happen is really that we work very strongly on integration. Because sometimes when we look at all the projection of anima animus quality type projections that go into a relationship without thoughts and feeling at least embodied in the internet, we have to look at the aspect of integrating those into our online life, meaning when we meet the person and so on, because then, you know, an email can be a wonderful augmenting factor to an existing embodied relationship. And that's the good part of it. It gives us a chance to stay connected and stay in touch if we limit its use, if we are aware of its limitation. Now, integration is one of the most important principles in psychology. We all know that. You know, already for years and centuries, it's always been our striving to get a sense of meaning by fitting together and balancing various elements of our psyche, because we all work on the principle that we need to make it complete and we need to make it a harmonious whole. So we need to be careful to bring the parts together that make that whole for us. When we don't get to do that, when it doesn't work for us, we're quickly there with great big terms, psychoanalytically or other. We call it repression. We call it disassociation. Or the most favorite one of all is splitting. You're just splitting this off. This is a split off part of yourself. While when we look at the healthy aspect of integration, we are willing, and many websites coo around that all the time, you know, healthy psychic behavior. We talk about insight. We talk about assimilation. Assimilation? Thank you. Or self-actualization. I can't even get these big words out, you know, although I coined them myself. So a major theme in many spiritual practices emphasized the attainment of connectedness and unity as a major theme. We read it all the time. The whole is greater than the sum of parts. We have known that for years. But here, suddenly, with the onslaught of the internet and web, we're forgetting about that principle. We're suddenly demanding that a part is just as good as the whole, rather than integrating them. And it's a fallacy. And we have to be careful. So where's cyberspace in this? Now, we could say, for instance, I said it's a laboratory of identity. It has a great connectedness to on a global basis. It has anonymity. So it must be good for the healthy for a healthy vacation from the daily grind of the face-to-face life. I mean, wouldn't it be wonderful recreation that the president of a big, important corporation has a stressful life? He can go on the internet at night and he can be the 15-year-old adolescent in the chat room and have some fun. He could be a better person because of it, couldn't he? Could he? Definitely? We'll have to talk about that. But the downside is when these identities that are created this way, and of course we had the chance to create many identities, when they overlap rather than integrate. And you can see what's happening then. All hell will break loose because suddenly the cross-dresser forgets to undress and arrives that way at the executive office, and I mean symbolically, mentally, and all hell will break loose. Because he forgot to slip back into the persona of the tough executive. And when too much of the unconscious stays unconscious, then you begin to act in a different identity without realizing it. So indeed, then, suddenly you adapt part of that identity. You can't get rid of them so cleanly anymore because they are so attractive. I looked all through 22 volumes of Jung to find some appropriate quotes around that. And I can give you the good news, I found two. Volume 7, on lack of integration. Rather than face the conflict, he will turn back, Jung talking, and as best as he can, regressively restore his shattered persona, discounting all those hopes and expectations that had blossomed under the transference than he was before. So he essentially says what I had just said. Volume 8. Consciousness is continually widened through the confrontation with previously unconscious content. Good Jungian principle, we have heard it many times. Or to be more accurate, could be widened if he took the trouble to integrate them. So it kind of brings home on the same level the dire need of integration. Sherry Turkle, who is a wonderful woman, and she wrote a great book, an even greater book, which she calls Life on the Screen. Anybody who is interested in the internet ought to read Sherry Turkle's book. It's just quite good. She gives a little, and I give you this little vignette she wrote, and it exemplifies part of that too. She says, the internet is another element of the computer culture that has contributed to thinking about identity as multiplicity. On it, people are able to build a self of cycling through many selves. Yeah, well put. I agree with it totally. An interior designer admitted to be nervous as she was about to meet a man with whom she had months of virtual intimacy. She's reasonably sure that he's a man rather than a woman impersonating. Why would he otherwise suggest a face-to-face meeting? She said she did not lie much to him in presenting herself, but feels a lot less inhibited in the virtual realm of the AOL chat room. She was hoping she could also be herself online. She could be her online me in the face-to-face encounter.
So it shows it with a bit of humor, the idea of what is going on. Now, I need to race on here a little bit, but the need for integration of the face-to-face and the internet, we have talked about that. And what the anonymity will do for us, it has two distinct sides. I mean, there's one, it will bring out the disinhibited acting outside easily, or more honest and intimate presentation of yourself that otherwise in face-to-face you were not able to do. Much depending whether you function better in an introverted or an extroverted way. Let me give you just a couple of things that came to mind that I read in literature, but that I also feel that are sort of typical for this because it is the construct of the internet and email. Status gets wiped out in the internet email because your anonymity will help you wipe out status, whether you're a big doctor or a small doctor, or whether you're large or small, it suddenly doesn't matter versus a face-to-face confrontation. Geography, spatial boundaries are gone. It's excellent for scientific research because suddenly the pool of people that can be spoken to if you want to share a minuscule topic that may have only one or two interested parties in this huge nation, now you have the world. Time and its condensation. I mean, synchronous communication is still difficult. It's not email. Yes, you can have it. There are instant messengers and chat rooms, and that will do it. But then there are expectations around that whole email thing. How often do we hear from people complaints and say, you didn't answer my email? I say, well, what is this? 24 hours and I'm dead in the water? I should have answered. I have people, and there are probably some people in this room who say, I'll check my email only 3 times a week. The hell with you. I have some colleagues that say, I check my email only once a month. So I say, well, why do you have email then? It's useless, because you may as well write a letter and send it by donkey. It takes a month. Why bother? And there's some truth to that. Record keeping. Now, that's an interesting feature of email, isn't it? Everything you say is kept as a record on somebody's server. And somebody is looking at it and having a good time with it. In a recent newspaper article, I saw that in the tragic paranoia that we are suffering from, this post-traumatic stress period we have, where we're rushing through one law after the other to catch all the bad fundamentalists and fanatics in the world. But our beloved Attorney General Ashcroft just quickly pushed in a new law where he and the FBI can use a program that he saw wonderfully has termed carnivore, which will, on any buzzword, on any search word, track, evaluate, and collect all email connected to it and put it on the FBI server. And that law passed 100-1. Got very little notice, but now we have it. Frightening to me. It's frightening to me. They have the audacity to even name it carnivore and spitting it right into our face. I know. I'm still screaming, Jim. But nobody listens to me. Another thing is when you sit in front of this box, you get definitely into a dream state. You ever had that? I mean, it's kind of becomes a little dreamy period of time. You see these images come, and then they lead you to another image and another side. And next thing, it's like a dream unfolding, except there is really no emotion or feeling in it. And then there comes the frightful experience of the black hole. The screen grows black. Nothing is going on. The screen is blank, and you sit there in anger and frustration that has not known its heights in face-to-face experiencing of many things.
I don't think I've been as angry as anybody in my life as I've been at this computer when it just went blank and I couldn't do a damn thing about it. Writing skills, that's a funny thing. I used to love penned letters on nice, fine, pressed Arches paper. Gone. I write one, people are scared to read it. You know, they say, is there something wrong that you're writing me this letter? I say, no, I just enjoy it. I have 3 fountain pens. I love it. People get afraid almost. Writing skills on the internet I find are useless to use, but very few people use them. I don't even know why we have spell check on the internet. People just write stream of consciousness writing, you know. They write, Peter, you know, I like you. Well, I just thought about it. Well, it wasn't really quite a true statement. I sort of like you. And it goes on and on and on and on and on and on and on. And so on. I just wanted to say a few pros and cons. Again, our dilemma, a lot of good, a lot of bad. I promised to you, in closing, an example of what I found in one website in the helping profession. Just a taste. Here's my colleague. One more time. My colleague, Robbie Bosnack, who thinks he knows everything about dreams, he has a huge website called Cyber Dream Work, where you can even write down, load down a talk program that he calls Pal Talk, and you can participate in online talking DreamWorks groups. It's quite intricate, very jazzy, and we had a discussion group at the last International Congress in Cambridge, and he's easy enough to drive you up a tree. He thinks he got it all. Huh? Oh, anything goes. He does have a national hotline on trauma counseling now and dream, and he just became the president of the American Society of Dreams, the ASD, and it just goes on and on. But Brutus was a fine friend. Now, I know some of you are Sandplay people, and you're happy to know that you will be out of business soon because it's all happening. Here is. Here is the virtual sandbox, Lucretia. Now, here is a program that is run by a couple of Venezuelan analysts out of Miami and Caracas, Venezuela. And needless to say, you can download, they have a virtual sandbox, they have all the increments. People put it together as an image, then they load it up to the server. And then, you know, they write back and interpret it. They say, Dear Jessica, da-da, the mere choice of mountains means this, and with peaks and pronounced and da-da-da. And then they end it like a bad horoscope where they say, you know, good luck and have faith in the path that I can tell you live within great solitude, but with deep respect that the cardinal lends to your life as a religious... So it goes on. But it's going on. It's going on. It's real. And it's used. And it's active. And very slick. No. One moment. One sec. Can I just finish this train of thought? Can you hold it, Pat? Great. I got to fumble through this, otherwise I get completely lost. The same website comes up Dream Bank. You send in your dream. There it is. Then it gives, it's for everybody to share. And then they interpret it. Dear Francisco, the image of the dream feels like an initiation ceremony. Well, if that isn't like a bad horoscope, because almost every dream is, in one sense or the other. Symbolically, we can look at those insects, they're coming from the earth as the element that will initiate transformation. You know, it's not, I'm not saying they're doing bad work or damaging work. They're doing some work, but I mean, we have to regard of what it is. It is nothing other than what I would call a good symbol dictionary. I can get the same out of my De Vries dictionary of symbols because they're described in there. So I just click, what is this? What does this mean? What does this mean? So if I haven't had enough after I did my sandbox and I had a few dreams interpreted by them, I go to their next little quirk and then I can do a tree test to really find out who I am. And here's the tree test. You see, they're still going, they are bilingual. They're doing a lot of work in Central and South America. So dibuja un árbol, I guess it means draw your tree, draw a tree, yeah. And then, you know, they have all the whistles and bells and tools, and you draw a tree, and then they immediately you feed it into the system, and either the automatic computer or a person will give it back to you. Pat. Guess what I did?
But my question is, who's doing
that? Well, it's they have such refined, and you know, I'm sure we have somebody here who can answer a question. I can just blindly move around there. There are search machines and so on that look for a name and a link. Like, you know, they have linked my website, they have linked my name to the last lecture I did at the Jung Society, they picked it out of that site. And then when people type in, for instance, dream enactment, they get a whole list of things that this Elting fellow has done. So to recap this, because I want to let you off the hook with one final very powerful image, but first, let's say, we have looked at, you know, at hello, let me just finish. I know you're all energized. I know you want to really let me have it, but could you hold on 1 second? We have really looked at it, at the psyche and the internet under the aspect of relationship, and that's what I wanted to send home with you. And we looked at the projection of soul and selves that are behind the screen. We looked at the fact that we should never look at the web or the internet as something, I am me and this is that. No. I am me and this is me. There is no that. We have created a world soul that I think somehow our essential orientation is changing, in as much as part of that soul that we used to, as depth psychology think, is only inside, lives also out there, and it's demonstrated in our creation of the web. It's our relationship to time and space as connections are more instant, you know, AOL Instant Messenger and all that. But is there really, you know, the Greek have topos, is Greek for place. So in one way we could look at it, there is really, you know, it isn't a utopian, a perfect place, a utopian, but there is more of an atopian, meaning no place situation right now, because the internet, the web, is really no place. There is no topos. What the web really is, it's a very refined perfection of the museum. It has bits and pieces in there that have been taken out of their natural habitat, whether it's churches, minds of people, things that have been created, technical bits and pieces, and they've been put together in the web, just like a museum. No different. Just like we take artifacts from churches, from ruins, from culture, and put them into the Metropolitan Museum, and then we walk through there and we ogle all at it. That's what the web is. One image I have. So I think the fear that my friend Peter Hallmark expressed, and I guess he had the real fear, or maybe they only have this fear in Zurich, that Jungian analysis is going to be outdated by the globalized offers of the web, I think it's premature. I think as therapists, psychologists, analysts, or whatever we are in the helping profession, what saves us is with all the wonderfulness of the web and email, there will always be the need to embody emotion and feeling, and the web hasn't quite made it yet. The written bite hasn't quite made it yet. Not sure it will not. You know, I'm sure probably going to happen too. Hopefully not in my life. So I've picked your curiosity a little bit, and I'm going to leave you confused because I'm going to end with, when I sort of thought, well, how do I end this lecture? How many of you know Hermann Hesse, the writer? Oh, wonderful. The glass bead game. What the web and the internet reminded me of is Hermann Hesse's concept of the glass bead game. Because what the glass bead game that Hermann Hesse conceived was, there are really no pearls of wisdom or pearls of any other value or pearls of mythical meaning. It all is reduced to this cheap little glass bead that we can all buy. They are available everywhere. And they have no meaning as such, like in the web. And the meaning we put in them. Now, unfortunately, the web doesn't come equipped with a Magister Ludi, this marvelous master that Hermann Hesse had in his book, who was sort of the mastermind who handled it all. He's missing. But guess who that is? We are. We are our own Magister Ludi. We're the own mastermind who need to deal with all these glass beads out there to instill meaning in them. And to, you know, in my memory of Hesse, and somebody may know the book even more carefully than I've read it a number of times, is that to get out of that syndrome of hanging out with these glass beads and being run by the mastermind who had it all, Magister Ludi, the way out was to go back into real life. And that's what we got to do with the web and the internet. We got to bring real life in it and treat it as part of us and realize we have created it. So, I look forward to a spirited and obviously embodied discussion of what I have rumbled. And I say, this is peterelting.com saying goodbye. See you in 10 minutes.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.